This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan. We're broadcasting today from the Knight Studio at the Newseum, Washington, D.C.'s newest museum devoted to journalism and the news business. Presidential hopefuls John McCain and Barack Obama trade jabs on the economy, trade patriotism, and just about everything else. Obama dials up Bill Clinton. General Wesley Clark ejects himself from the veep stakes, and both candidates dust off their passports. It's Wednesday, and time for our weekly dose of the political junkie.
There you go again.
You do that,
when I hear your new ideas, I'm reminded of that ad. Where's the beef?
You don't have Nixon to kick around anymore.
Although we weren't able to shatter that highest, hardest glass ceiling this time, thanks to you, it's got about 18 million cracks in it.
But I'm the decider.
NPR political editor Ken Rudin joins us every Wednesday to talk about the presidential campaign and other political news. This week, John McCain visits Colombia and Mexico to tout the benefits of free trade. Barack Obama heads soon to Europe and the Middle East to burnish his foreign policy bona fides. Obama defends his patriotism. McCain meets with the Reverend Billy Graham, and Obama focuses on religion, too. We'll focus on that a little bit later with Michael Gerson, a former speechwriter for President Bush. So if you have questions about both candidates' appeal to religious and evangelical voters, our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. And you can join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Political junkie Ken Rudin is with us here, as usual, at the Newseum. And as usual, we begin with a trivia question. Ken?
Hi, Neil. Well, the news of the week, or part of the news of the week, was Wesley Clark's comments made on Face the Nation on Sunday, and we'll talk about that in a bit. But Wesley Clark ran for president in 2004, and he considered running for president this year, although he had never run for any office before that, let alone be elected to any other office. So who was the only, who's the last major party presidential and vice presidential nominees who had never run for office prior to them being on the ticket?
Not even dog catcher.
That's correct.
All right. The last major party nominees for president and vice president, respectively, who were running for those jobs as their first elected political office. If you think you know the answer, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Of course, we'll accept questions or requests or answers from the audience here at the Newseum as well. And Ken, Senator Obama felt he had to take up the issue of patriotism once again, this time in Independence, Missouri.
Well, Independence was not a coincidence. It was the hometown of Harry S. Truman, the president with no real middle name. And also, it's Independence Day coming up this week, this weekend. So obviously, it was something he wanted to burnish his credentials. Obviously, a lot of rumors about Barack Obama on the internet, and many of them questioning his patriotism regarding whether he sung the Pledge of Allegiance, cited the Pledge of Allegiance, wore a flag pin, put his hand over his heart. So as he did with race back in March in that famous speech in Philadelphia, he needed to address another issue, and that was patriotism, another issue that seems to be hurting Democratic presidential candidates in the past.
And this was an issue that one of his surrogates, General Wesley Clark, the former NATO commander, the man in charge of the Kosovo War, well, General Clark took this issue up, as you mentioned, on Face the Nation with Bob Schieffer, where he said, well, you know, John McCain, he's a war hero, he's a hero to me. Of course, he was a prisoner of war in Vietnam all those years. But
he hasn't held executive responsibility. That large squadron in the air, in the Navy that he commanded, it wasn't a wartime squadron. He hasn't been there and ordered the bombs to fall. He hasn't seen what it's like when diplomats come in and say, I don't know whether we're going to be able to get this point through or not. Do you want to take the risk? What about your reputation? How do we handle it publicly? He hasn't made those calls,
Bob. Well, General, maybe, could I just interrupt you? If you're
sure.
I have to say, Barack Obama has not had any of those experiences either, nor has he ridden in a fighter plane and gotten shot down. I mean,
well, I don't think riding in a fighter plane and getting shot down is a qualification to be president.
Most of the media played just that last 4 seconds.
Right. Well, it's very interesting. The fact that we're still talking about it means it's obviously touched a nerve, but it's not really, to me at least, it's not exactly what it appears. I don't think, as some people have said, that he denigrated, that Wesley Clark denigrated or denounced or ridiculed or belittled John McCain's service. He talked over and over again that he was a war hero, he respects his service. What he did say was a response to Bob Schieffer's question that, well, Barack Obama wasn't shot down and didn't fly a plane, and so Wesley Clark responded, that's not qualifications to be president. One, John McCain has never said it's a qualification qualification to be president. Two, Wesley Clark has, I think, stating the obvious. I don't think he criticized McCain as much as he made a fact. But the fact that he said it on a day, or at least at a time, when Barack Obama was trying to give his patriotism speech, I think it was interesting how quickly Barack Obama threw Wesley Clark under the bus. He immediately said that, you know, he disassociated himself from all those comments. And the McCain campaign, thinking they had an issue, seeing they had an issue, came up with this McCain Truth Squad to talk about, you know, to defend the candidate against so-called attacks on his military service. But again, Wesley Clark did not attack his military service.
And, of course, both sides have truth squads at this point, the Obama anti-smear campaign as
right.
well. Let's see if we can get some answers to the trivia question. And, again, it's the last major party candidates who ran for president and vice president.
Nominees.
Ran for president and vice president who did not. That was the first time they were running for public office. And let's see if we can go to Boyd. And Boyd's with us from Milwaukee.
Hi, Neil. Hi, Ken. Well, the two people I have in mind, I don't know if you would consider them, though, part of a major party, but H. Ross Perot and James Stockdale.
Major party? No.
No. Well, I mean, clearly, those are the first time they ever ran for office, but they ran on an independent the first time, the Reform Party the second time, so they were not as not a major party candidates.
Okay. All right. Fair enough.
Nice
Thanks
try.
For the opportunity.
Okay. Bye-bye. Let's see if we can try now. This is Richard. Richard's with us in St. Louis in Missouri.
Hi there.
Go ahead.
Well, my wild guess is Wendell Willkie, and is it Frank Knox, 1940?
Well, Knox was Landon's running mate in 1936. Both Knox and Wendell Willkie in 1940 did not run for office, but the answers are more recent than that.
How do you know that?
I make it up. No.
Nice try, Richard. Let's see. We have somebody here at the museum who thinks they know the answer. Hello.
Hi. The answers would be Sergeant Shriver for vice president and Eisenhower for president.
That is correct.
Ding, 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 ding.
Dwight Eisenhower, general, president of, Columbia University, running for president in 1952, and Sergeant Shriver, when every other Democrat said no to George McGovern after Tom Eagleton dropped out, Sergeant Shriver ran his first campaign for vice president in 76.
So you can collect your no prize on your way out the door. Anyway, getting back to political news, of course, last Friday, Senator Clinton joined Senator Obama on the stage in Unity, New Hampshire, and then there was a phone call between Senator Obama and former President Bill Clinton.
Well, what was interesting about that is that for the most of the campaign, people said, would Bill Clinton please stop talking? And then when Bill Clinton didn't appear in Unity, New Hampshire, everybody said, why isn't Bill Clinton here? Why isn't he talking? So, yeah, I don't think he could have it, you know, neither way he wins. But obviously, Barack Obama knows that whatever divisiveness that Bill Clinton may have brought to this campaign, he is still desperately needed for the Democrats to unite in November against John McCain. And so there was a phone call this week subsequent to the Unity meeting, and they're deciding what to do with Bill Clinton, because prior to that, Bill Clinton had only given out a 27-word statement endorsing Obama. And, you know, for Bill Clinton to say anything in 27 words or less is pretty remarkable.
Speaking of stars of administrations past, General Colin Powell, speculation this week that he may come out, of course, a Republican all his political life, nevertheless, that he might come out and endorse Barack Obama.
Right. Actually, I don't think we knew that he was a Republican until 1996 or 95.
His political life.
Right, exactly, yeah. When he endorsed Bob Dole. But he did meet with Obama. Obama and Powell reportedly met with Powell in his Virginia office last month, in the middle of June. And while Colin Powell's spokesperson says that an endorsement is not looming or imminent, there is some speculation that he may endorse Obama sometime after Labor Day.
And this would be a major break for the person who served as Secretary of State in the first George W. Bush administration.
It would be. And again, you know, there are some very conservative Republicans who are not happy with John McCain, but it's very interesting. Colin Powell's never seen on the right wing of the Republican side, and yet he feels very strongly that that Barack Obama, he's conceded that he's advised Barack Obama on foreign policy issues. He's done that with McCain as well, and he's a friend of McCain, but there is some indication that he may break party ranks and endorse Obama.
And as we've all learned in politics, sometimes it's the little things that will get you. And Democratic Congressman Tim Mahoney from Florida apparently found that out the hard way this week.
This is my favorite story of the week. Tim Mahoney is a congressman from South Florida. He was elected in 2006 only because the previous Republican incumbent was Mark Foley, who was involved in a sex scandal on Capitol Hill. So it was, and this is a district that George Bush won by 8 percentage points as a Republican district. And the only reason Tim Mahoney won is because of the Republican problems. So last week he sent out a flyer, and the head of it, the title was Honoring Those Who Defend Our Freedom, and it's talking about Mahoney's record on veterans issues. So they have a picture of two U.S. servicemen in their uniform and one retired gentleman with a bunch of medals and everything, but a close-up of this senior citizen showed that they were all Soviet Union medals with hammers and sickles. They took basically a photograph of some Soviet war hero and threw it with a long celebrating U.S. military, honoring our servicemen, which is pretty embarrassing.
Pretty embarrassing, yeah. Veteran of the Battle of Kursk.
That's right.
How do you get caught?
Well, all you do is look at the picture. You see next to the guy's lapel this hammer and sickle pins on his shirt. So they said, well, it was an honest error, but it's, you know, this is a district that the Republicans think they could win back, and this did not help the Democratic incumbent.
Well, we'll maybe hear more from Congressman Mahoney a little bit later in the campaign once he takes the egg off his face. Anyway, our issue this week, we're going to be talking in just a moment with Michael Gerson about the issue of religion and both candidates' appeal to evangelical and to religious voters. Barack Obama, unusually for a Democrat, is actually trying to win the votes of some evangelicals who have been, well, very solidly Republican since the days of Ronald Reagan.
Well, you know, the few Democrats who have talked about religion openly were Bill Clinton and Jimmy Carter, and both were the last two Democrats elected. Coincidentally, maybe, you know, they were also Southerners, and that helped too. But the Democratic Party has obviously had this faith gap with evangelical voters. Evangelicals constituted 23% of all the voters in 2004. That's a lot. And to ignore that, you do that at their peril. And of course, you know, a lot of people have criticized President Bush with the, you know, his evangelical reach out programs. They say it, you know, violates separation of church and state, blah, blah, blah.
But and some people are uncomfortable that Obama is leaning in that same direction.
Yes, they are. That's true. But it certainly could help the Democratic Party.
So if you'd like to talk about the issue of both candidates' appeals to religious and evangelical voters, give us a call, 800-989-8255, or send us email, talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan. We're broadcasting today from the Knight Studio inside the Newseum in Washington, D.C. Religion is back on the campaign trail. At an appearance yesterday in Ohio, Senator Barack Obama praised faith-based groups and argued they could help solve many of the country's problems, from pollution to poverty. But while he focused on religion, he has yet to make inroads with many evangelical voters. Senator John McCain has a 3-to-1 edge among that group. If you have questions about either candidate's appeal to religious and evangelical voters, or what role, if any, religious organizations ought to play in government, give us a call. Our phone number, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. And you can join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. NPR political editor Ken Rudin, of course, is still with us. And joining us is Michael Gerson, who was President Bush's chief speechwriter and senior policy advisor until 2006. He's now an op-ed columnist for The Washington Post and a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Like many of the best and brightest of Washington, D.C., he's decamped to the Aspen Institute in Aspen, Colorado this week. And Michael Gerson, good of you to be with us today.
Good to be with you. The weather's fine.
Darn you. In an op-ed last week, you wrote about that intersection of politics and religion in the campaign. You described Barack Obama as a not your traditional evangelical when it comes to biblical interpretation and certain moral issues. Yet you also say he has a certain appeal.
Yes, that's true. His background is really the United Church of Christ, which is one of the premier liberal denominations in America. He's never claimed to be an evangelical, but he is also the most comfortable candidate of the two between McCain and Obama talking about his own faith. McCain talks a language of duty and honor, but not really of religion. And Obama's background as a community organizer in Chicago, as a member of a large African-American church in the south of that city, I mean, it gives him a real opportunity here to appeal to a group that has not been in the Democratic camp for quite a while.
And so far in the campaign, the issue of religion has been, I guess it's been the parade of the pastors, the people who endorse John McCain, who he's had to reject in the whole Reverend Wright situation with the Barack Obama's church in Chicago. It's nice to see this issue get spoken about in terms of substance rather than just accusations from one side and the other.
No, I agree with that. We've gone through that stage where, the swapping attacks on different religious traditions and pastors. But, Obama's speech yesterday was a breakthrough in many ways for Democrats, although not unprecedented. If you remember in 1999, Al Gore talked about encouraging faith-based solutions to social problems. He gave a speech in Atlanta. He tried to use it as a theme, but it very much became Bush's theme. And I think it showed some maturity, political maturity, that Obama doesn't believe that anything associated with George W. Bush is off limits. He's talking about expanding the faith-based initiative that the president has identified with. But it's also very authentic in this case. He knows the kind of geography of hope in these city, in inner city settings. And they always include the element of the African-American church reaching out to individuals in need. And so he's seen that this is not something unusual or threatening. It's something that, his experience, makes it a very authentic argument.
Well, let's see if we get some listeners involved in this conversation. 800-989-8255, and we'll start with Becca. Becca calling us from Denver, Colorado.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, my comment is I recently graduated from a seminary, and I'm probably one of many independent voters. I feel that there's a new generation of evangelicals that are more community-oriented, service-oriented, and therefore more drawn to Barack Obama because of those like-minded values. I feel that... there was a lot of talk of pacifism in my somewhat conservative seminary, and interestingly, our values would align a whole lot more with the Democratic Party in this case than they would to John McCain.
Do you think you speak for the majority of the people in your seminary?
No, I don't. I think that there were definitely groups of us, but I think that I can speak for the majority of my seminary in saying that we were open-minded. Or we would be open-minded to many of the candidates, or to each of the candidates, not lean towards the Republican candidate because we are Christian and evangelical.
Michael Gerson, what do you think of that?
Well, I strongly agree with the caller. I talked to evangelical young people at Wheaton College or Harvard University, and there's quite a few. And if you ask them, who's your model of social engagement? Who do you regard as your example in this? You'll often get Rick Warren, who's very, Pastor Rick Warren, who's very involved on AIDS and Africa issues. And you'll often get Bono, who has been one of the great leaders on focusing attention on development and disease. There is a shift here. I don't believe, I think evangelical young people, I think they're often still, if you look at the polling, pro-life. But you've had a broadening of the evangelical approach to issues like sexual trafficking, like AIDS, like malaria, and like poverty. And for me, that's an interesting and probably healthy development that I believe from talking to Obama's faith outreach person, they're organizing in this cycle in the fall a series of house meetings and dorm meetings, sometimes on evangelical universities and campuses, to talk about these faith issues in a setting that's favorable to Barack Obama. They're going to try hard. There are obstacles here. Barack Obama's not pro-life. Some of his social views are very different than many, even most evangelicals. But he is, I think, personally very committed to this outreach.
You don't think Bob Jones University is going to mirror the University of Wisconsin in Madison, do you?
No, and I think, you know, there's a diversity in the evangelical community. But I would say George Bush got 78% of the evangelical vote in 2004. I don't believe John McCain's going to get that much, given his background, his approach. I don't think it's going to be a 50-50 issue, but any gains that Obama makes in this community are, you know, directly undermine the Republican coalition that has elected Republicans in the past.
Becca, thanks so much for the call.
Thank you.
And good luck with your career.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's get a question from here in the audience at the Newseum.
I'm Carolyn Peterson from South Bend, Indiana. What does Barack Obama have to do to get rid of all the rumors that he's a Muslim? They just keep coming back.
Michael Gerson, this is an issue that strange story out of that town in Ohio the other day in the paper that a majority of the people in the town seem to believe this story, no matter how often it's been debunked.
Yeah, I mean, other than saying it's vicious and unfair, all he can do is what he's doing. He talks very persuasively about his own background, his own faith. I think that he, in many ways, is more like Jimmy Carter than, say, Mondale, Dukakis, Kerry, some of these other nominees. Jimmy Carter, you'll remember, in 1976 in particular, talked very directly about his born-again experience, about his experience of faith. That resonated with a lot of people. I don't know. I mean, he's gotten into some trouble, for example, with his advance people, removing Muslims in head covering from the back of pictures out of fear that he's going to be identified there. I think that's probably an overreaction. It's probably a problem because he wants to appeal to Muslim voters who are a large and growing section of the American public. But I think all he can do is talk about his own faith in persuasive ways, and I think he's pretty good at it.
Mm-hmm. Ken?
Michael, I was struck by the fact that John McCain had to go to North Carolina last week to meet with Billy Graham and Franklin Graham mm-hmm. to talk about his own personal faith, and then he also met with evangelical leaders in Ohio, a state that ultimately was responsible for reelecting George Bush in 2004. The fact that a Republican nominee has to brandish his religious credentials this late in the game, especially after all we know about John McCain, is probably a bad sign for the Republican Party, no?
Yeah, there's a huge organizational gap here. John McCain won his nomination after he had been divested of almost his entire campaign staff, because he'd gone through a terrible trough. And, Barack Obama went through a very tight election cycle where he built his strength. He's an excellent fundraiser, an excellent organizer. The McCain outreach is late. It's less impressive in many ways than Obama's. The contrast to Bush is fairly clear. I mean, you know, McCain has in the past set out sometimes to offend, religious conservatives, used them as targets, which he did, 8 years ago. So there's a history there, a history of conflict. I talked to one major Republican campaign advisor who described the McCain campaign as like a Mickey Rooney, Judy Garland movie. Every day they wake up and say, let's put on a show. Okay. The Obama campaign is highly organized in this outreach and effort. They've already had 200 of these faith-based town hall meetings around the country, led by staff, not Obama, and they've been focused on this for a while. And I think there is a gap there.
How important do you think is McCain's choice of a running mate? I mean, you think of the Huckabees and the Romneys, the people who the evangelicals supported during the primaries. How crucial of a sign does he send with his choice of a running mate?
Well, I think it's interesting. I think that some conservatives, movement conservatives in a variety of backgrounds, are looking for this as a sign. You know, does he take the more conservative element of his party seriously? But I don't think that that's the way the McCain campaign is thinking, by the way. I think, right now they're not doing badly among evangelicals. They're not doing badly among conservatives. It's not a huge crisis in their world. And I think they believe that this election is going to be won in the center by outreach to independents. And McCain has that ability, too, in a way that, like Romney or Huckabee didn't in the primaries. Mm. And so, I've, you know, in a running choice of running mate, he may well lean more in that direction.
We have an email question from Joe in Plymouth Meeting, which I think is just outside Philadelphia. Anyway, Barack Obama will get nowhere with evangelical voters because Obama believes in abortion, even late-term abortion. The press is staying away from this for Obama's sake, but it is out there and will not go away. And that's something that you've written about, Michael.
Yeah, no, I haven't stayed away from it. If you look at some other Democrats who have tried to moderate the Democratic position on abortion, like Tom Daschle, who was opposed to late-term abortion, or Senator Moynihan, who opposed the partial birth abortion practice. Obama's not in that category. He did not support the partial birth ban. He did not support a Born Alive Protection Act, after abortion in the Illinois state legislature. So I think it is a problem for him. But if you look at the recent Pew polling on American religion, the extensive polling that they do, you know, evangelicals who attend church, once a week or more, that are deeply and closely affiliated with their churches, tend to be very, very pro-life, and I think are going to be have a tough time, accepting Obama. But those who are less closely affiliated with their religious traditions, only about 45% of them, might be considered abortion restrictionist. So there's some diversity in that community that Barack Obama could try to appeal to.
We're talking with Michael Gerson, former speechwriter for President Bush and now an op-ed columnist for The Washington Post, and with, of course, political junkie Ken Rudin. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. Let's go to Larry. Larry with us from Elkins Park in Pennsylvania.
Hi. I'm calling from the point of view of an Orthodox Jew, and God willing, that could make a difference in New York State. I think one should, evangelical should look at Obama's speech to AIPAC and compare it to his recent speech to the evangelicals and ask if they really believe he means either one of them. And on the other side of the aisle, I think McCain has shown that he's willing to compromise on a number of social issues. And if, in fact, which is what I advise, we elect a very strongly Democratic Congress and Senate, and McCain as president, I think we can go forward on all those important issues.
A Jewish vote likely to be more of a factor in Florida than perhaps in New York, Michael Gerson. But Larry's got a point. Senator Obama has had some difficulty with Jewish voters.
He has, because of the views of some advisors, which is, not something necessarily that you can control very well. Also because of a general foreign policy approach that he adopted in the primaries, which was, immediate, unconditional negotiations with the leader of Iran, the leader of Cuba, the leader of Syria, the leader of North Korea, which they've significantly backed off of. His advisors have softened that position significantly. And so, I think he sent some signals that for Jewish voters and for allies in Israel were deeply disturbing in early stages of those campaigns. On a lot of issues, however, that you find a move to the center that Obama has undertaken just in the last 3 weeks. I think that that's a reality of the campaign. The caller clearly questions the sincerity on a lot of these issues, but it was probably necessary for him for a variety of reasons.
And some of Obama's supporters questioning what he's doing with the FISA issue when he's backing the bill that's in Congress now. Anyway, Larry, thanks very much for the call.
Death penalty and guns, yeah.
Yeah. Let's get a question from here in the museum.
Hi there. My name is Chris Gordon. I'm from Greensboro, North Carolina. My question is, why does faith even matter in a general election? When historically did the focus on faith with nominees even begin?
Michael, it seemed to become a significant factor in electoral politics in the Reagan administration.
Yeah, I think there was a lot of that. But, of course, Thomas Jefferson was attacked during his election as an atheist. The attack from the Adams people was that if he were elected, the churches would be closed. Those were pretty tough campaigns
happened.
They had a significant religious overtones.
Guy made a deal with France.
Right, exactly. But in modern times, you had an interesting phenomenon. You had in the 1920s, after the fundamentalist modernist controversy, evangelicals, for the most part, withdraw from public life. I mean, they had almost no political or cultural involvement in America. And that began to shift in the 1970s and the 1980s with the development of the religious right, as an important political force. That movement in some ways is discredited because of its tone. I think it's institutionally exhausted. But that the religious involvement in politics is not going to end, because of course it was not just true of this movement, but it was true of the civil rights movement, which was an expression of religion in public life. With Martin Luther King and most of the leadership of that movement, it was true in the abolition movement, with many, if not most, of abolitionist leaders, had come from either evangelical or Quaker backgrounds, and so this isn't new. There's a long tradition here.
Just time to read this comment from Marianne in Wilmington, Delaware. I strongly resent your comment that to say that Obama is a Muslim is vicious and unfair. How do you think 6 million Muslims in this country feel when they hear a statement like that? Obama is handling this badly. Every time he acts affronted when he's called a Muslim, he insults Muslims. We'll have to leave that because we're out of time. But Michael Gerson, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Michael Gerson was chief speechwriter for President Bush, now an op-ed columnist for The Washington Post, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Mentioned that he was at the Aspen Institute with many of the brightest and best from Washington. You'll note that Ken and I are still here in Washington. Ken, thank you very much.
Take two Aspens and call me in the morning.
Right. Coming up, the old story of the federal drug agent who wasn't. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Like much of rural America, Gerald, Missouri, population 1,171, has a persistent problem with methamphetamine. Then, a few months ago, a man who called himself Sergeant Bill arrived in town. Sergeant Bill identified himself to local police as a federal agent. He wore a T-shirt that read, Police. He had a badge. And he began to make arrests. As it turns out, the badge Sergeant Bill brandished was more Woolworth than Washington. Sergeant Bill wasn't a sergeant at all. For months, Bill Jacob, who used to work as a wedding minister and as a security guard, pretended to be a federal drug agent. He duped residents of Gerald, Missouri. He fooled police officers. Eventually, an enterprising reporter for the local newspaper unraveled the impersonation. From time to time here at the museum, we ask journalists, how'd you get that story? And today we put that question to Linda Trest, a staff writer for the Gasconade County Republican in Owensville, Missouri. If you'd like to talk with her about her story, especially if you live in Gerald, Missouri, our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Linda Trest is with us today from the member station in St. Louis, KWMU, and thanks very much for your time today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And how did you unravel this story?
Well, I unraveled the story by just kept asking questions. I found out about the story when people told me that there was a federal agent in town who claimed to be from two different federal agencies, didn't need search warrants, and was just very brash in his manner. When I began checking around, I couldn't come up with names or any information on him. So with the help of our Franklin County Sheriff, Gary Tolke, I eventually, after several weeks, was able to discover his name, and then was able to find out he was not a law enforcement officer in the state of Missouri or anywhere else, and was certainly not a federal agent.
And he was, in fact, even if he was violating, going in and searching people without a warrant?
Yes, he was.
And as I understand it, that's really, some people called you and said, what's going on? I watch Law & Order on TV. I watch CSI. Those people need warrants.
It was really kind of unusual because people weren't sure whether you still needed search warrants. They said, we know they can now tap our phones, so maybe they don't need search warrants either anymore. People were confused because he said he was a federal agent. They thought maybe he was allowed to play under different rules. And that's when the sheriff said, oh, absolutely not.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone needs a search warrant.
What about the police, though? In Gerald, did they not think he needed a search warrant?
They backed his story up and said federal agents did not need search warrants.
And have they
certainly
read the Constitution lately?
Evidently, they have not. But, I'm sure it made their job much easier to ignore that one little piece of paper called a search warrant.
And that's one aspect of this story that makes it pretty interesting. He was doing a pretty good job. He was cleaning up a lot of people that, a lot of people wanted cleaned up.
I disagree with that. I don't think that there is a huge methamphetamine problem in Gerald. There is certainly a meth problem, as there is everywhere. The amount of drugs that they confiscated is minuscule compared to the damage they've done. I think a significant amount of marijuana is the biggest recovery they made.
But the police seemed to go along with him because they thought he was getting results.
The police, I believe, went along with him because they were able to write impressive press releases.
Huh. And his methods were less than gentle, as I understand it.
That's absolutely for sure. He kicked the doors literally off the hinges in at least two homes, but always kicked his way in, immediately ordered everyone to the floor, always had a gun that was described as a sawed-off shotgun with a pistol grip, in many cases pointed it to the heads or faces of the people who he was arresting, did this with their children in the room watching it all, handcuffed everyone, the moms, the dads, anybody in the house was handcuffed, drug out into the front yard, in front of their neighbors, and then were asked to start naming names.
And then asked to start naming names. And you're suggesting that who was he, you know, when you found out who was he really?
He was an unemployed past security guard who had worked part-time at Best, lived with his in-laws, I believe. He and his wife lived with her parents and was no one connected with law enforcement.
And do we know why he did this?
No, we don't. He's told the media since that time that he did it to try to help. His story is that he came to town on an innocent conversation with the chief of police and was kind of lured into this kicking down doors and being a federal agent scam. The chief of police said at that time that he came in claiming to be a federal agent.
And that he
I'm not sure which story is correct.
But he also claimed that Sergeant Bill had set up this phony phone line to check his credentials.
That's correct. The chief of police did say that. And that when he faxed the information in, he called to confirm. A female answered, said everything was in order. And then Mr. Jacob told him a few days later his boss had approved his transfer. He now belonged to the Gerald Police Department.
And where
he was there at their disposal.
And there at their disposal, and thus began. And how long did this go on?
It went on for at least a month. It went on a really regular basis. They said he had come into town about 2 months prior to that and would just come in a couple of times a week.
Now, as I understand it, though you report for the Gasconade County Republican, and that's based in a town, what, about 10 miles away from Gerald, that you live in Gerald.
That's correct. And the Gasconade County Republican has a section in their paper that covers the town of Gerald.
And I wonder what's been the reaction of your neighbors to the disclosures in your newspaper?
The people that I've talked to are angry. They're very, very angry that this happened, that his credentials were never checked, that checks weren't made on him that are made on people's dogs. If you have a dog in the city of Gerald, you're required to show paperwork that it's been vaccinated and buy a license for it. And even that cursory check wasn't done on a man that was allowed to carry a firearm and have access to all of the records in City Hall.
Let's see if we can get a caller on the line. And if you'd like to join us, our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. Our guest is Linda Trest, a staff writer for the Gasconade County Republican. And why don't we go to Michael. And Michael's on the line with us from Boston.
Hi. What does it say about police enforcement of the law in general and the drugs war in particular that we're appalled by this private citizen doing many of the things that actual federal agents do every day and doesn't seem to raise an eyebrow? They do get warrants, but quite often the warrants are based upon, let's say, less than solid evidence. But beyond that, his behavior seems kind of normal, and we're appalled, whereas, you know, if he had a real badge, then it would be okay.
Well, not the warrant part, but Linda Trest, I wonder if you've thought about that.
I have thought about that, and I'm glad he brought that question up. The main focus of the story, since it's become national, has been on, what a Hooterville this makes our town look like. It makes a small town America look silly. And I don't think that's the case. I think that's a very valid point. The actions of Mr. Jacob and the General Police Department are not uncommon. Too often we look the other way when one small portion of anyone's civil rights are violated. And as a nation, we all made smaller by that. And I think it's time that we insisted that all law enforcement agencies, federal, local, everywhere, reread the Constitution and really understand what those are. Because that Constitution covers everyone, even low-life drug users. They still have civil rights, and they need to be upheld.
Michael, thanks for the call. Let's see if we can go now to this is Jim. Jim's with us from Eagle River in Alaska.
Hello. Thank you. Yes, I'd like to comment that the police chief in Gerald reportedly claims he tried a few checks and he thought he claims essentially incompetence. And I've noticed a lot of people who have taken oath claim incompetence when they're discovered cheating. And it appears to me incompetence is frequently a cover for corruption. And it should be treated as an admission of corruption when someone claims incompetence.
Well, what's happened to the police chief there in Gerald?
At this point, nothing. He was investigated as well. The charges are all waiting down in the federal attorney's office. The charges should be filed sometime this month. But at the moment, Chief McCrary is also free and is waiting for charges to be filed. It'll be interesting to see what he will be charged with.
When you say also free, is Sergeant Bill free?
Oh, absolutely. He was flown to New York City yesterday and has been appearing on talk shows all day today.
I guess as a reward for his activities. Jim, thanks very much for the call.
Yes, you're welcome. That's amazing.
Yeah. Let's see if we can go now to line 7, if I can find the right button. Maggie. Maggie with us from Lansing in Michigan.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had wondered, are all of these cases going to be compromised since there were no warrants? If there were any drugs or any potential criminals taken during this time, are those going to be compromised now?
Fruit of the poison tree is, I think, the phrase that's used in legal terminology for an illegal search.
If they weren't compromised just by the fact that he wasn't a federal agent, there was an event that happened that I'm sure spoiled all the cases, and that was the chief spread the evidence out around his office on Saturday afternoon. Most of the evidence was gathered on Thursday, and they got some kind of call, and he and every other police officer in the Gerald Police Department went running out, jumped in their cars, grilled out of the parking lot, and left the doors unlocked, left the chief's office doors open. The evidence was out in plain sight and touch, and they left a prisoner handcuffed to the bench. And there was no law enforcement. There were two civilian women left behind.
And thus raising,
prisoner.
Well, chain of custody seems the least of their problems, I have to say. Maggie, thanks very much for the call. At that level, who appointed the police? Is this an elected position in Gerald?
No, it's appointed by the mayor. Chief McCrary was the fourth police chief appointed from April till January of last year. So in that eight-month period of time, he was the fourth police chief. And he was very new to the job. He was very new to – doesn't have a lot of law enforcement experience and is fairly young. And I might say that the mayor also walked through the chief's office, saw the evidence laying out, saw the doors open, the doors unlocked, and no one seemed to think that that was worth even talking to the chief of police about.
Again, our guest is Linda Trest of the Gasconade County Republican, who broke the story that Bill Jacob was not a real federal officer in Gerald, Missouri. He was trying to arrest what he thought were meth dealers. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go to Charles. And Charles with us from Raleigh, North Carolina.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
You all may have already covered this, and I may have missed it, but I have several friends from high school that are in law enforcement, and the warrant issue aside, when they go into or make entries, particularly a forced entry into a domicile or a building, they're required to identify themselves and have badges showing, you know, show identification. Did this guy do this, or what happened with that?
That's a great question. No, he didn't do that. Several of the people asked who he was, and he said, I'm a federal agent. That's all you need to know. You can call me Sergeant Bill. That's all you need to know. He would never identify himself with any agency beyond the first day. The first day, he said, would say either that he was a federal marshal or a DEA agent. Beyond that, he wouldn't tell people or give his last name.
And did, okay. And did anybody look at the badge at all?
No, he wouldn't hold it up long enough for anyone to. I understand it was a badge left over from his days as a security guard.
As a security guard. Okay. Thanks very much, Charles.
Well, thank you very much.
Let's see if we can go to that's the wrong button. I'll hang up there. Let's go to Glenn. Glenn in Columbus, Ohio.
A lot of times police confiscate cash that they think is associated with drug crimes, even though the person they take the money from is never charged. Did any money change hands this way and stay in the police department?
There are several reports from people who say cash is missing from their home. In one case, a man had gone next door to his neighbors and had just gotten there when he noticed the jail police pull up. They broke down his door, entered his home. He had left $80 on his coffee table. When he got back home, the money was gone, and the police were gone. They never even told him that they'd been in his house. There's another case of some old money, some antique money that was in a jar that the police took as evidence. They said that was evidence that he was a drug dealer. Even though the jar was so dusty and the spot on the dresser around it was so dusty, it was clear it hadn't been moved in months. And that's now missing.
How much longer we can put up with this stuff? It's crazy.
Thanks very much for the call, Glenn. And that raises the point. Did you have a question here in the audience at the museum? Go ahead.
Yes. My name is Lauren Vitz, and I'm from Chicago, Illinois. And I was just wondering, you had said that he went to New York to do some talk shows. Do you plan on going to more, I don't know, more public venues to tell your side of the story?
Hey, this is a public venue.
Not that Talk of the Nation isn't a big venue, but, you know, to things that are maybe more nationally always.
You were on the CBS early show this morning, okay. Correct?
That's correct. I was. And I do think this is the peak right here.
Well, any thoughts that we had that the people out there in rural Missouri are rubes just vanished. You're very media savvy. And I did want to ask, though, what's the fallout going to be? Is the sheriff, the county sheriff, still investigating?
The investigation's complete. The Sheriff's Department, the Highway Patrol, and the FBI did a coordinated investigation, and it took a long time because there were so many people whose civil rights were violated. But they have compiled a report and turned it over to the U.S. attorney, and they will not say anything until the charges have been filed. There'll be no further word now until the charges have actually been filed. But if things go as they normally do, that should come in about 2 weeks.
Linda Trest? Great story. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks again for having me.
Linda Trest, a staff writer for the Gasconade County Republican, with us today from the studios of KWMU, our member station in St. Louis. You can find links to several of her articles on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.